This podcast is brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. This is Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Innovative thoughts from baseball's best coaching minds from around the world. Brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. Now your host, former USA Baseball National Team Coach, Peter Caliendo.
Hey, good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, wherever you're at in the U.S. and around the world. Again, thanks for joining us, folks. We are thrilled that you can join us. Remember, we're live on Facebook. And if you're on Facebook and you want to see both of us, myself and the guest, I know you don't want to see just me. You want to see the guest, go to YouTube at Peter Caliendo, and we are live on YouTube. So you can see the show live there going on right now. And special thank you. Don't forget, when you're on YouTube, subscribe, do us a favor, just hit the subscribe button. That helps get the show out, lets everybody know about it, and we really appreciate it. And remember, the audio goes on baseballoutsidethebox.com. Check that out. 3 years of shows, and YouTube has over 100 shows currently going on right now. Folks, thanks for joining us again. I'm your host. This is the show that loves to interview baseball's best coaching minds who love to challenge the status quo. And I am thrilled today because we have Major League Baseball's Toronto Blue Jays pitching coach, Pete Walker. And let me tell you, it's going to be a fun show. We're going to talk pitching, obviously. We're going to talk about the Toronto Blue Jays, but we're also going to talk about probably the best lineup of speakers convention in the U.S., no doubt about it, the Mohegan Sun World Baseball Coaches Clinic. It has been going on for a long time. I had a great honor of speaking at it 1 year. I'm not even sure I should have been there. If you looked at the number of speakers and the people that they have, I mean, I'm just going to rattle off three managers: Derek Shelton with the Pirates, Chris Woodward with the Rangers, Sal Fasano, the bench coach, catching coach for the Braves, Rocco Baldelli, good Italian, with the Twins. I mean, it just keeps going on. Butch Thompson with Auburn. But Pete's going to tell you all about this, and I want to welcome our good friend with the Mohegan Sun World Baseball Coaches Convention and the pitching coach with the Blue Jays. Pete, how you doing, buddy?
Great, Pete. Great to be here. And you did a lot of my work for me. I mean, you rattled off all those names, and
I got excited.
Pumping our event up. I love it.
I wasn't going to. And then I got excited because I'm thinking, look at all these guys, man. These are just the major league managers. So we're going to talk more about that. And I don't want to even waste any time. Since I hit that right away, let's just go right into the convention. Okay. Give us a little background on how it started, when it started, why it all got going on, who's involved, and then we'll get into the actual event.
Sounds great. You know, first of all, thanks for having me here. Great show, and look forward to watching the replay. Yeah. But, our event started back in, I believe, 2003. It's been so many years. I think we've done 17 years. This year will be our 17th, maybe 18th. I don't know. I lose track. But we've been doing it a long time. Obviously, we teamed up with the Mohegan Sun, a world-class resort and casino. Paul Sturgis, the former chief Sun at the Mohegan, is a great friend of ours and one of the directors of the event. So he's been tremendous to us over the years. Obviously been able to use the Mohegan Sun as a first rate facility place that we can hold our event, which people just love coming to. So that helps. Obviously it's a great draw for a good time for the coaches to come. And then obviously the event itself is just second to none as far as I'm concerned over the years, the presenters we've had. But Rick Orlick, we teamed up with Rick, Rick's marketing firm, and Rick's been a director of the event and basically runs the event. He's done so much for this thing and grown it into what it is today. He's been instrumental in us being where we are as an event and one of the top events in the country, if not the world. So very excited about being teamed up with Rick. And then my brother, Andy Walker and Roger LaFrancois, the two other directors. So we teamed up and formed this thing a number of years ago. And again, it's grown into, it's easy. We're a little biased, but, probably one of the best events in the world. So very excited about this coming year. Disappointed we can't be at the Mohegan Sun with the COVID, but we're going to do this thing virtually. And, we're excited about it. And like I said, this is probably our best lineup we've ever had. Obviously, we want people to take part and be able to, we want to separate ourselves from the rest. And, you mentioned some of the major league managers we have this year: Rocco Baldelli, Derek Shelton, Charlie Montoyo, the manager of Toronto.
Yeah, of course.
Chris Woodward in Texas, a former teammate of mine and someone who's done a great job down in Texas, a young manager. So, you know, especially with the direction of the game today, you know, talking to some of these young managers is exciting, and seeing how they're, you know, transitioning with a lot of the new age thinking and the technology and how things are done. It's a different game. And so it's exciting to talk to these guys. And then obviously the collegiate guys you mentioned, Butch Thompson, Steve Trimper at Stetson. We've always had great collegiate presenters and coaches. You know, Scott Strickland's been involved. And so, you know, I don't have my list right here in front of me. I could rattle off every name, but yeah, it really is quite a group. We've even dive into the mental performance and the strength conditioning. So we have Jimmy Van Ostrand, who's a sports psychologist with the Blue Jays, and the Cressy Performance Group is involved. So, I mean, we cover every aspect of the game with some of the best clinicians in the world. I know I ramble a little bit talking about it. I get excited, but it really is going to be a great event. And lastly, the dates, it's January 11th and 12th, and then the 18th and 19th. And it will run successive Mondays and Tuesdays. So it's probably a really good time for people to watch. It doesn't take up their weekend, Monday, Tuesday evening, in consecutive weeks. And the key for that, we're going to actually have one live session, one live day of sessions, from Stetson University. So we're going to be on the field and actually with live demos and everything. So it's going to be a really neat concept. So again, baseballcoachesclinic.com is where people can check in, you know, check it out. And I believe it's only $79 up to November 1st, then $89 up to January 1st. So it's for that price, the amount of information, and you get to play it back, and it's not just a one-shot deal. You can keep it, and it's really exciting stuff.
Yeah, you know what's great about it? It's amazing. First of all, if you go back and go to the website, again, baseballcoachesclinic.com, check out all the speakers they had in the past also. I mean, obviously, they've got great connections to be bringing in. So, and as you said, you vary it in different aspects of the game. It's just not one specific area right. That you're focusing on. I want to give a shout out to Roger LaFrancois, who I met, went with me to France doing a coaching clinic. Your brother, Andy, obviously played in Holland, you know, so he's got the international connections there too. You know, the other thing I wanted to ask was this, the clinics that are going on, you mentioned live from Stetson, yeah. But are the actual speakers live?
Yes.
When you're watching them?
Oh yeah. Yeah. We're going to be actually, you know, the majority of our sessions will all be live sessions. So, which is really neat. There might be a few pre-recorded in there based on, you know, people's availability at that time, but most probably 70, 80, 90% of those sessions will be live. And again, those live sessions at Stetson will be, you know, for people to tune in, and you're going to see Steve Trimper on the field, running infield defense, running cuts and relays. You know, we'll have some hitting sessions from Stetson, and we'll have different speakers coming into that facility. So, you know, from other coaches from around Florida as well, some of the top clinicians and presenters. So it's really exciting. I mean, we're still finalizing a lot of the details. But come January, it's going to be, you know, a real exciting event. And obviously, you know, the international component is real important. You know, we've considered us a world event, the Mohegan Sun World Baseball Coaches Clinic. But this year we're really attacking that and, you know, looking into different areas around the world. Obviously, Pete, you're going to help out in that area. We're going to have international presenters from Holland, from Australia, from, you know, from different areas around the world. So really excited about that part of it. Maybe you can even add a little bit to it.
Absolutely. And folks on Facebook, if you got any questions about the Coaches Clinic coming up in January, the best one when it comes to speakers, when it comes to learning, because there's so many great aspects of the game that are here. And I did want to mention that I joined forces with these guys, love what they do. And I joined forces to kind of add an international flavor. They already had international guys going there, because I'm familiar with quite a few guys who have attended the clinic in person. So obviously we're going to get guys internationally getting to this. But what's unique is that the U.S. coaches are going to be able to experience certain guys from different countries and what they teach and some of the methods and techniques that they use. I think that'll be interesting. Our good friend Jeff Crochelle from Canada, one of the best in the business, will be with us. Eddie Diaz, five-time world champion. I mean, he's won from the Dominican Republic. He's won three Mexican championships and two Caribbean World Series, 5 in 3 years. He's going to be joining us. And then Martin Niehoff, from the Netherlands. Talk about creative. They're going to be talking about all kinds of stuff when it comes to the development of the game, the athletes themselves. So, and we're going to keep adding, and we'll let you know about the new coaches that are joining us internationally. Pete, the other thing is, there's a question and answer section too, I believe, right? That where coaches can kind of ask questions. How's that going to work?
Yeah, that's great. Great point. Glad you brought that up. We actually have, you know, our sessions will be 35, 40 minutes long. Some may be longer, but then at the end of that session, there'll be an opportunity for a Q&A. So it's not just, you know, watching someone present, you know, a speaking head, so to speak. We'll have live demos, and then the coaches that are presenting will be available for a Q&A from some aspect. But it should be, you know, again, working on the finer details right now, but it's going to be an interactive session where there is opportunity for these coaches watching to present questions, to ask questions, and to get some answers. So that's always been a big aspect of our convention in the past, you know, having an ability to ask questions following a presentation. So we want to continue that to make sure that there's an interaction and the availability of these presenters to ask or to answer those questions.
All right. Now there's a lot of clinics going on all over, you know, you got high school clinics that go on.
Yeah.
And if I was to ask you the question of, what's the difference between the Mohegan Sun World Baseball Clinic compared to others? Now, I get it that a lot of people are doing different things, but what would be the uniqueness of your convention?
Well, you know, it's always been the venue. So we're trying to dress that up, obviously, virtually. So, you know, having the Mohegan Sun as a venue, and we hope to be right back into that facility next year in that casino and resort, which is incredible. So that's our plan. This year is a one-year deal with a virtual component. You know, obviously, we may keep that for future years, but we'll still have a home base of the Mohegan Sun. So that's always an attraction. But we do. I just think it's the quality of presenters we bring in. And we research. We don't just bring in anybody. We bring guys that can present and you know, come in and make an impact. And I think what we see is these coaches come in, and it's not just sit in a lecture hall and just listen. They'd have opportunities to interact. There's a lot of live demonstrations, which we want to continue virtually this year as well. And I think that's the key, the live demos, the drills that you can actually see and be a part of, as opposed to just sitting there watching a screen. So that's really been, I think, the separator with us.
And folks, when you go to the website, baseballcoachesclinic.com, check it out. Twitter, World Baseball CC, Facebook, World Baseball Convention. They got everything listed at the top. Check those out, you know, because then you can follow every time they have new speakers, every time they introduce speakers, get a good lineup. I'm just amazed, you know, this lineup for $79, you know, I know it's not an infomercial, but I mean, it's ridiculous, the price. Yeah. And coaches jump on this right away because, I mean, you're getting all these speakers. And what's unique about it, it's taped also. So that you're able to go back and look at it.
Right.
And that's, I think, is different because of the fact that when it's taped, you know, you're sitting there, you're going to take notes, but we know better than anybody. You got to listen to it 2-3 times sometimes to really pick up some of the finer details.
Yeah, I think until June 1st, actually, it is free for anybody that has joined the event and been a part of it. So you have plenty of time to go back and look over every session because there will be some sessions going on simultaneously. And I know it's always tough. That's always the toughest part about the event, you know, is the choices that people make and you have to make. You know, there's 2 or 3 good presenters going at the same time. So that is really important, I think. And that makes you feel a little bit better if you happen to be missing something at that time. You know, you can go back and look at it and take notes and maybe you're really enjoyed a session, you want to watch it again. So I think those are all important aspects of the event. And again, that separates us from the most of the other events for sure.
Absolutely. All right, man. Anything else about the convention? And then I want to jump into some pitching, some of the Blue Jay stuff. Everything.
No, I appreciate it. No, it's a great event. And we look forward to it. It seems to come quick in January. And, you know, I'm really looking forward to this one for sure. But let's talk pitching.
Yeah, let's do it. Folks, we're going to talk a little pitching. First of all, you give us your background a little bit. Played Major League Baseball?
I played, you know, obviously like everybody else, you grew up playing the game. I went to the University of Connecticut, played for Andy Balock there and loved my time at UConn. There's a lot of UConn alums in the big leagues.
Oh, yeah, Jim Pender speaking.
Jim Pender's, of course, has been huge for our event. So he's there every year, and he's a tremendous presenter. What he's done for that program up at UConn, I mean, you look at some of the major leaguers he has out there playing, you know, Springer obviously jumps to mind, but, you know, I was a UConn guy and always will be. So it's exciting stuff. But obviously went to UConn, drafted by the Mets, played 18 years of professional ball, fortunate enough to play 5 seasons in Toronto with the major league team in Toronto. And that's where I've been since 2002. I did spend 1 year in Japan playing for the Yokohama Bay Stars in 2004. You know, like everybody else, you have injuries and everybody's got a story. So, you know, always wish my major league career could have been a little bit better, but I did happen to get, you know, enough time up there and experience and was able to perform at the highest level, which is incredible to say. Again, yeah, continued my coaching career with the Blue Jays I ran the rehab coordinator position for a year. I was a pitching coach in AA. I was the bullpen coach for John Farrell for a year. Then I took over the pitching duties with John Gibbons and have been there now with Charlie Montoya. And this would be my eighth season coming up.
Yeah, Montoya, as you mentioned, speaking at the convention, Montoya. Yeah. Nine seasons of pitching coach. Yeah. That's in today's game, that's long. We call you a veteran there because a lot of guys don't last that long in one organization.
Yeah, I think it's been obviously I've been here a long time as a player and a coach, and we've had, you know, some transitions in different front offices and such, but yeah, I've maintained good relationships with the people that are here. It's an awesome group. I've been very fortunate when I look back at it that I'm still here and I enjoy what I'm doing. And I think, you know, when you're able to do that, you consider a place a home. And, you know, I've been here so long. I, you know, there's other organizations out there, I'm sure, but this is one I really want to see through. We've been to the postseason. We've been to the American League Championship Series a couple times in 15 and 16. And I'm really, really want to get to the World Series with the Blue Jays. So we're getting close. And, you know, this year was a step in the right direction. Obviously making the postseason with a young team, and hopefully next year and a few years after, things just get better and better.
Boy, and I tell you what, a young team and an exciting young team. I'm only going to mention Bichette, Gurriel, Biggio, Guerrero. Yeah. I mean, incredible young guys. You know, it's become an international team in some ways. But before we get into that, I want to ask you, because you mentioned Japan. What did you take out of Japan playing there as a pitcher that taught you something to maybe, you know, you brought into your players into the U.S.?
Yeah, you know, in 2002, I made about 20 starts in Toronto. And, you know, I was a starting pitcher. 2003, I was a starter. I made maybe six starts most of the time out of the bullpen, so I was kind of a long reliever. And that's when Yokohama approached me. I was going to make the team in 2004 in Toronto as a kind of a long reliever, spot starter. You know, and Yokohama approached me in spring training in our organization, and they wanted me to be a starter over there. So I really went there with the intention of being an impact starter, maybe even staying there. Ran into some neck issues about, you know, seven or eight starts in, made 10 starts, and it didn't go as well as I wanted. So my time there was relatively short, but I did, you know, did have a great experience. I wouldn't trade it in for the world to be able to see Japan and experience baseball in Japan. It's a different game. You know, I was more of a finesse contact pitcher, so it wasn't a great matchup, to be honest with you. I think the guys that have success there are the power guys.
They like that.
Yeah. So I had a lot of foul balls. There was a lot of deep counts and a lot of foul balls, and you know, they're very contact approach first, and you know, putting the bat on the ball, a lot of slapping, a lot of infield hits, choppers. You know, usually the foreign players are the big boppers in the middle of the lineup, the Americans or the Latin players, you know, hitting three and right. four. But usually the
did
top
you go
of the
through spring? Did you go through spring
I did not.
Training there?
No, I signed with them. My contract was sold and signed with them at the end of spring training. So I didn't have to go through spring training, which I hear is a great thing.
Did the pitching coaches try to, you know, like help you or tell you something? Yeah. And then you were kind of like, well, I don't know if I can make this change. Something unique there?
No, you know what? I didn't run into too many. I like to throw a lot. I like to long toss. I like to throw long bullpen. So I kind of fit in. And I threw a split finger fastball. So they loved that pitch. They wanted me to throw it as much as possible. They knew I wasn't a power guy, but they wanted to, you know, they really loved the split finger fastball. So they really didn't do too much mechanically as far as pitch selection. I think things are different now. You know, we talk about today's game and guys really utilizing their strengths and kind of pitch design and making adjustments with certain pitches. But in Japan at that time in 2004, it was still kind of like here, you know, where they just kind of, you know, it was a lot more. They left you alone a little bit and they just wanted to see some results. And again, I only made 10 starts. I ran into a neck issue. I ended up having neck surgery. I had a 2-level Ooh. Fusion in my neck.
Wow.
So I had a titanium plate and four screws somehow I ended up making the team in Toronto the following year and pitched a couple more years in the big league. So, but I wouldn't trade that experience for the world in Japan. It was really great. Enjoyed
awesome.
It.
Awesome. And then now you jump, you know, the Blue Jays signed Ryu, who I saw in 2008 win the Olympics, beat the Cubans on a bases loaded. The Korea was winning I don't exactly remember the score, but I know it was one run, 3-2, and there were bases loaded. Gurriel was up. So if Gurriel hits a base hit, they're the home team, possible, you know, they win the Olympics. Well, amazingly, ground ball to the shortstop, double play, Korea wins the Olympics on that play, right. Bottom of the ninth. So an amazing pitcher, Ryu. What have you learned? Have you learned something from him,
yeah,
you know, coming over here, how he does things, what unique things he does?
Yeah, he's interesting. I mean, obviously he had some success in LA. So coming into Toronto, you know, kind of being our ace right out of the chute, you know, we kind of left him alone. I wanted him to do his thing, get comfortable. And obviously this year was a crazy year. I mean, it was not a year for anybody. It wasn't a normal spring training. You know, obviously we got his routine down. We had great discussions, to be honest with you. He speaks a little bit of English, but his interpreter, Brian Lee, is fantastic. Loves to talk the game of pitching. Obviously I wanted to know what worked and what, you know, and you know, what things he liked to talk about, going into spring training in the season. You know, we talked with some people in LA and kind of laid the foundation down to how we're going to approach it and work with him. But he was real easy to work with. He's a true professional, comes to the park with a plan every day, gets his throwing in, has a really good throwing program. There's a couple things mechanically we had to keep checks on. And it was pretty basic stuff. You know, he tends to rotate a little bit too much laterally, not staying up over the ball and getting out of his slot occasionally. So his cutters and stuff would get a little flatter. But for the most part, it was pretty simple, repeatable delivery. He knows who he is as a pitcher, which is something we really emphasize in our organization for guys to, you know, we want to find out who they are. We want them to understand who they are and what they need to do to be successful. Obviously, Ryu knows, can change speeds, can locate his fastball, can pitch those right-handers in with a cutter, and can throw any pitch at any time. So, you know, I think it was good for other pitchers to see him work and to see how he pitches and how he utilizes his pitches and has so much success. So he brought a lot to the table, just our pitchers, to be able to, you know, when you get to really watch an ace or a true number one, number two starter, you just see how they work on a regular basis. So it was really good for our guys. He was a pleasure to work with.
Oh, and, I can see that. And, yeah, you know, as we all know, the Asians are extremely disciplined. So what I'm curious about is his routine prior to games and even recovery. Was there something different that he did than anybody else?
Yeah, I mean, he's big in massage therapy and, you know, really deep tissue work. And I know that's one thing I did notice when I was in Japan, the amount of deep tissue work, soft tissue work and massage therapy that goes on. They're big into flexibility, being limber. The weight training is important, but not nearly as important as, you know, keeping their bodies loose. So that's something we did notice with him, obviously. He took a lot of pride in that to maintain in between outings and to keep himself, you know, prepared for the following outing. Didn't throw side sessions. So, you know, I had one other pitcher like that was Mark Burley, you know, that didn't throw sides between, you know, so you don't get to work on things necessarily off the mound. But he's adamant about that's his program. That's how he's always done it. And obviously he's had a lot of success. So his work would be in his, you know, finishing up playing catch and his pull downs coming in, you know, you look at the shape of some of his pitches, but that's the one thing that he is a little bit different than most guys here. But again, Mark Burley did it, you know, for a number of years and through 200 innings, you know, 13 years in a row in the big leagues. You know, you can't really question those guys.
Hey, correct me here, because I'm thinking you guys get Robbie Ray from Arizona.
Yeah.
Right. And here's what's unique. And look, I know sometimes it's a good change for players to go to another organization, but it almost looked like, you know, two different guys, Robbie Ray in Arizona and Robbie Ray with Toronto. Robbie Ray really picked it up. Were there changes you had to make with him? And then the other part is, even though we say we're going to make changes with a pitcher, whatever they may be, mechanical, how easy for the, you know, it's during the season, how easy for them to pick it up?
It's not easy. And major league coaches, pitching coaches, hitting coaches, it's tough. You work with your players all the time. Obviously, you know, in the off season, in the minor leagues, player development, it's so much easier to make changes, major changes, especially. So in the big leagues, it's more minor changes. If there's a major makeover, it really has to be done at a alternate site or sent down to the minor leagues or in the off season. But with Robbie, we did notice, obviously he was having some, arm changes, like arm slot changes in Arizona. And they were doing that on purpose. He had shortened up quite a bit. He lost his arm stroke. So coming back to Toronto, he had just started making the change back to that stroke in Arizona. So coming to us, he was starting to get a little bit more comfortable with it. But the biggest thing with him was really glove placement and you know, not being so fine with his pitches in and out, because he was certainly, you know, looking back at video, a little bit more wild in Arizona. So we just wanted to get him in the box and attack the zone. So it was really about pitching more up and down in the zone and using more of the plate and letting his stuff work, because he's not really a fine pitcher. He's not going to dot it up. He's going to let it eat at 95, 96, 97. And that's what he was doing with us. And he seemed to find his rhythm. He seemed to find his slider. You know, I think his slider can get a little big at times. So, you know, trying to make sure we keep that nice and tight and late is important. And he had some effective outings for sure. Even his walks, he still had some walks with us, but mm-hmm. They weren't wild walks. They weren't, you know, where it was a foot, 2 feet away or trying to go one side of the plate and missing on the other. It was always around the glove. So I felt really good about him on the mound. I know we used him in some different roles. You know, we had an opener for him. We brought him in after an opener a couple of times. He also made some starts against us and had a dominating outing against the Yankees. So, you know, I think he's in a position to take off again, to be honest with you. So I'm hopefully he does next year, and hopefully we have him back.
You know, the other thing is, you notice I've been watching the playoffs a lot. Maybe you could help our coaches understand this. Most pitchers, it seems like in the big league, especially if they're throwing hard, are up and down.
Right.
They're not across as much unless they're off speed guys.
Sure.
That's changing, obviously, for a lot of pitchers. What else am I missing there in those plans?
Well, I think one thing, I mean, obviously, we didn't have a great year with walks. That was the one area that hurt us. So we're trying to get more on the plate with certain guys, and even next year will be more of an emphasis. We just don't want guys pitching behind the count, picking early. I think really, like, that's baseball. That goes back forever. So that's nothing. That's not rocket science. You know, it's strike one, getting ahead, and then letting your stuff work. You know, expanding late.
Let me ask you. No, and I want to stop you. I apologize, only because came up when you said, because I want our coaches that are working even with young kids to understand this. Strike one doesn't necessarily mean right smack down the middle, especially in the big leagues. Now, you can get away with it in youth baseball and some other areas. Strike one could be down the middle. So kind of talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, strike one can be down the middle sometimes. It depends on the hitter. It depends on their approach. Some guys are real passive early. So we know the first ball hackers. We know the guys that do a lot of damage early in the count. But if they're not a guy that does damage early in the count and they're not a guy that swings a lot early in the count, then, hey, go ahead, take the strike. Obviously you're correct though, for guys that can do a little damage, the guys that are aggressive early, we're trying to get ahead with strike one, but it's still a pitcher's pitch. It's, you know, might be outer half, outer third, it might be bottom of the zone, it might be top of the zone, but being a little bit finer without thinking I gotta pinpoint a pitch, because I think that's when guys get a fearful approach. They start to pitch away from contact, they trying to miss bats, and all of a sudden they're 2-0. They're 3-1, they're 2-1, they're pitching behind the count too much. And if you don't have good secondary that you can throw anytime, you're going to get waffled. You know, you're going to get hurt pitching and throwing fastballs and hitters counts consistently in the major leagues. So, but I agree with you. You know, we're not throwing cookies down the middle. We're throwing our good quality pitches early in the count, trying to keep them in the zone.
You know, and it's interesting. I don't know about you, but sometimes on television, I'm watching games and it drives me nuts. I'm not sure I could handle it mentally as a manager, because it seems like a lot of pitchers are getting behind in the count. It seems like they're trying to be too fine. I mean, maybe you can explain this one. I use Snell as an example with the Rays. You know, he's always full count, full count, full count. He's 90 pitches in 40 in four innings. Now, but I'm assuming there's a game plan there, and that is probably the game plan. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's frustrating. No, I'm sure it's not, you know, the game plan, I'm sure, is that's the game plan. You're right. But it's frustrating when you have guys like Snell and that throw a lot of pitches and have to come out of the game early, you know, in the fifth or sixth inning, and they have such dominating stuff. I had that with J-Hap. You know, J-Hap was similar in Toronto, where he was 90 to 100 pitches in five innings a lot, and it was frustrating. The one thing Jay ended up doing, we started focusing down on the zone again, and that's something we can talk about, which is interesting.
Oh, yeah.
So many pitchers have really made the adjustment up in the zone. And I think hitters are starting to make a little bit of an adjustment, but there are a lot of foul balls, there are a lot of deep counts because of that. There's not always a lot of damage up there, but hitters are starting to make the adjustment. So with Jay, we started, you know, we got away from the four seamer up and started using a two seamer down the zone to go along with a four seamer up. And honestly, that made a big difference with him. And I know he carried that into his next contract in New York and whatnot. But I think guys get caught up in work in one area with their fastball, and they still got to change eye level. They still got to change, you know, the hitter's approach a little bit to keep them honest. But for some of the guys, I think we've noticed that are really just exclusively working up in the zone now, they run deep counts. They miss up. They get foul balls up.
Yep.
They get a swing and miss up. But I do think they got to be able to work both parts of the zone up and down. So I do think, you know, we had a guy, a sinker ball this year, TJ Zoik, who, you know, you almost think gets pushed out of the game because sinkers can't survive now, right? Or guys that pitch down in the zone because of the launch angles. But I see a difference. I see hitters, Aaron Judge, different hitters making that adjustment to the ball up now. And all of a sudden it's opening up down in the zone. So I think sinker balls may be coming back, which is interesting, you know, getting the ball on the ground, and maybe the strikeouts, you know, the sexy strikeouts will disappear a little bit. But I find that interesting, and I'm curious to see how the next few years play out.
You know, that's what's fun about the game too. You know, it's a game of adjustments, right? It's the people that are trying to figure out, well, if you're going to make an adjustment, now I got to make an adjustment. Mm-hmm. It's kind of back and forth, and it's fun to watch that. And we're trying to tell young kids, especially, and this is the hardest thing to do for coaches that are working with young kids, even high school kids, you know, the pitcher, no matter what, Pete, has the advantage. The numbers show it. Even just on your fastball, if you're able to move it around different zones, different times, even if you just threw that, you got an advantage. But yet it doesn't seem like a lot of pitchers mentally really believe that. And here's where I'm going with this. Yep. The Dodgers, a lineup of guys that don't swing at many outside the strike zone. You know, they're pretty disciplined in a lot of ways, but they could also get 7-8 pitches per at bat. They can really battle. So that makes a tough lineup. And then on top of it, the home runs they can hit. So, Pete, you're the pitching coach. What's your plan against a team like that? I know it's individually per hitter, but overall plan.
Yeah, I mean, it is difficult facing a lineup like that in particular. And there are a few of them out there. You know, they don't chase a lot. You know, they do damage in the zone. So, you know, you just have to trust your stuff. And you really, I think in those situations, you really got to exploit. Those are the areas you go after certain weaknesses. You know, if there is a weakness, you might try to exploit it a little bit more. You know, if you find that one hole that a hitter has, you may try to attack it a little bit more. When there are multiple holes, it makes it a little bit easier to kind of pitch your game. But when there's one or two, or you get a team that doesn't chase, you can't pick, or you're gonna find yourself in big trouble. So I think those teams, to be honest with you, are the teams you really got to get ahead in the count. You really have to pitch ahead in the count. If you pitch behind, it's going to be a long night. So making them force them to hit the ball early, I think, is important. And, you know, because, you know, the more pitches you see, the easier it becomes to hit. I mean, they just get a better feel. So my best stuff, first or second pitch, has a better chance of getting them out 7-8 pitches in. And what you find, a lot of these guys end up making that same pitch that they could have made early in the count, late in the count when they have to, in a 3-2 count. They finally give in a little bit and make that pitch, but they've seen 7 or 8, and all of a sudden it's a double off the wall or a home run. But if you make that same pitch, first or second pitch, the timing quite isn't there. It might be a pop-up. It might be a ground ball. So I just find it fascinating. I think you have to be probably more aggressive to those quality teams that don't chase out of the zone. I mean, you got to just come after them and let your defense work a little bit.
Yeah, and stay away from those walks, because the Jays, the Rays have a great defense. So let your defense do some work.
That's the name of the game. No doubt. You know, the earlier you get contact, obviously the game flows a little bit. You keep your pitch count down. You can pitch deeper into the game, and, you know, you save your bullpen a little bit.
Absolutely. Well, here's always something, an interesting question comes up. Pitcher strength, hitter's weakness. Yeah. I know every pitcher is different, but how do you handle that part? Does a pitcher go with their strength many times, or do they go towards a weakness? And if that weakness might be the pitcher's weakness also, does he stay with that?
No, we emphasize pitcher's strengths for sure. I mean, I think anybody in their right mind really should be. You know, I think a lot of the times pitchers get into trouble. In player development in the minor leagues, you can work on things, right? You can work on things maybe you're not as good as. Or good at. But as you get higher up the chain, you're closer to the big leagues, you get in the big leagues, you should know who you are and what you do and your strengths. You should be attacking your strengths. Obviously, like I said, if there's a weakness that's really easy to spot and it's an area that we can get to successfully, we'll try to exploit it. But again, I'd rather have my pitcher throw to his strengths than the hitter's weakness on a consistent basis. Because again, you're going to find yourself behind the count, not confident in your pitches. And I really want those guys maximizing what they have. So I would certainly encourage pitchers to, you know, if you got two solid pitches or three solid pitches, you know, it's always that guy that's tinkering with the third or fourth one and working on it. And it takes away from everything else because he's so focused on utilizing that pitch and somehow finding a way to, you know, make it effective that it decreases the effectiveness of everything else of your other good pitches. So I think one thing we do emphasize in Toronto, and I'm sure other teams do too. So it's, again, not rocket science, but it's really pitching to your strengths and we can adjust accordingly. But I want you to know what you do, well, and we're going to attack those areas.
Yeah, folks, I'm sure you know, if you follow the game a long time, you know, there's a game plan that goes in this, and sometimes the pitcher doesn't throw it where he's supposed to. That happens. That's part of life, right? And they hit it. I mean, you can't say, well, why did he throw it there? Well, wait, before you ask any young kid, why'd you throw it there? Ask him where he was trying to throw it, because maybe he was trying to throw it in the right spot.
Right.
You see this on TV a lot. Not a lot, but sometimes. Mm-hmm. You know, you see a sign, one sign, two sign, three signs. The pitcher shakes it off, and then the pitcher decides to go with the catcher. And then all of a sudden, it's a double in the gap, two run score. But the pitcher wanted to throw one pitch. He didn't do it. Who makes that decision all the time? Is there a final?
The pitch, it's always the pitcher's decision. I mean, ultimately, it's a suggestion coming from behind the plate. It might be a strong suggestion in a certain situation.
Right.
But it's still a pitcher's career. You know, we give them that freedom. And that's why they all can shake at any time. Obviously, going in, it's great when there's a good pitcher-catcher relationship. We have a good game plan. They're rolling because it should be one finger pretty much with nobody on base. And that pitcher-catcher's in a nice rhythm. But most of the catchers that I've dealt with haven't had an issue with a pitcher shaking. You know, they understand that, hey, they might not have conviction in that other pitch and they feel a little bit better about this one. All right, let's go with it. So ultimately, it's the pitcher's decision. You don't want a ton of shaking throughout the course of the game because it just affects the rhythm of the game and the flow of the pitcher. So that's why game planning is important and having a game plan going in. This is kind of what we want to do with this guy, you know, 1 through 9. So they both have a good feel what they want to do. The pitcher buys in, the catcher buys in. So you kind of avoid too much shaking. But there are certainly times the catcher reads a hitter differently than the pitcher on the mound. And there might be a little bit of a difference in opinion.
Yeah.
And that's usually, hey, timeout. If you're really emphatic about something behind the plate, I've also told the catchers, hey, give it again. And then if they shake you again, then you're off the hook. But if you give it to him twice, you're really letting him know that I think this is the pitch you should go with. And if they shake, then, hey, then it's on him.
And then there's times you got to go out and say something, I'm sure.
Yeah.
When you go out, it's not always about pitching, is it?
No, it's not always. You know, most of the time it is. You know, it can be that the next hitter coming up. It can be, you know, how we're going to approach this guy, you know, depending on who's up next. Righty lefty matchup type thing could be to give him a little bit of a blow, you know, because he's out there for 20. Usually it's in that 20 pitch range. You'll see pitching coaches go out knowing that they don't want to go out too early. Sometimes you go out too early, 7 or 8 pitches in, and it turns into a long inning. Then you're scrambling to get a reliever ready and you don't have the time to buy for him. So there's a method to most pitching coaches and when they go out. But it usually it's in that 20 pitch range. And it's a situation where you're trying to give the pitcher a little bit of a breather to get out of the inning, or you're trying to give your reliever time to warm up. And then it could be mechanical. It could be a young kid that's overthrowing. It could be a young kid that's panicking a little bit because he's in a tough situation. You just want to relax him. So there are a lot of reasons to go out. Sometimes to talk to the catcher, to mix up signs. So with, you know, multiple guys on base. So there are a number of reasons to go out, but typically it's in that 20 pitch range, you know, to give the pitcher a breather.
Great stuff. Any advice on when you go out there, maybe some things you shouldn't say to the pitcher?
Yeah, you know, that's interesting.
Especially for our younger coaches, you know, younger guys working with young kids.
Yeah, no, for those coaches, obviously negative thoughts. I'm big on positive thinking and always can get out of it. Any pitcher I've ever talked to, hey, you're one pitch away. You know, it's a situation where, you know, he might be in a bases loaded jam, but you tell him he's the one guy that can get out of this. You know, you've seen his stuff. You know how it works. Just trust it and let it happen right here. You know, let's get a ground ball. Let's keep the ball at the bottom of the zone and get out of this with a 6-4-3 double play. So I try to remain encouraging and positive, pump them up. I mean, I'll I'll rarely really get on somebody, but I might be a little bit emphatic and try to fire him up a little bit to lock it in, you know, to kind of block out any exterior situation or issues that are going on. And try to really lock into them and just show that you have passion and you're in it with them. I think that's important, that they're not out there by themselves.
Now, you get to the park, you know, and you got work to do. Kind of give us a background on what your day looks like prior to the season. And I bring this up because as we watch the games on Major League Baseball, we're seeing, obviously, as shifts have been going on for a while. And I'm just using the Rays as an example. I know all of them use them, but they just seem to be in the right place, right time a lot. How does that work when you have a pitching plan, right, for that hitter, and you're going to throw to certain zones, certain pitches, but then you've got to have a defensive plan for every pitch? Yeah. The computers help with this, obviously, isolate it all?
Sure. Yeah, we have great analytics team. We have a group that presents information well. We do shift a lot, but what we've found is that the more we try to pitch to the shift, it doesn't really make much of a difference. We're still going to pitch the way we pitch for the most part. We get burned every once in a while. You know, if you got a left-handed hitter and you got a shift on a full shift and you're throwing a sinker away for some reason, I'm just saying, and a guy hits a dribbler right through the shortstop hole, it's for a base hit. It's frustrating, no doubt. But typically if we're shifting that far, the hitter doesn't make that adjustment. So he's trying to pull that ball and typically it'll be a rollover 4-3, he's out. So we don't really change too much of what we do from a pitching standpoint based on the shift. Occasionally we will. Occasionally, as a pitcher, you make the adjustment. It might be more of an opportunity to kind of throw that cutter in, you know, pound that fastball in if we have a shift on, so we'll pull it. But typically that guy doesn't try to – that hitter still tries to pull the outside pitch and rarely goes the other way, because if he did, we probably wouldn't be in a shift in the first place. So, but you know, everybody gets burned by it. Tampa was very good at it. We were good at it, but Tampa was exceptional at it. I think they shifted far less than a lot of teams this year too. From what I heard, when you look at the number of shifts through the course of the season, but they did seem to be in the right position a lot. So they do a really good job with it. And I do think, you know, as a pitcher, I pitched with, we used to move a little bit. We didn't shift, but we used to move a little. And you would recognize that, and you just understand that it's more of an opportunity to maybe get inside on somebody, knowing that you're safe, especially if you can keep it on the ground. So, but we do game plan, you know, separately, and then we get together with the, you know, the infield coach, the outfield coach, find out where the player's going to be, you know, positioned, and we can adjust accordingly. But for the most part, we don't change what we do very much.
How about during the game? Advice, you know, what do you do during the game? Obviously, you're watching your pitchers. When they come in, you know, maybe some talks you give. Or what's your advice there for pitching coaches?
Yeah, I like to communicate. I don't like to overdo it because I know as a pitcher, I didn't love to have a pitching coach every inning sitting next to me telling me what I did wrong or telling me what I need to do next inning. You know, you're locked in. And I would say most major league coaches aren't like that in the minor leagues as well. I think in college is a little bit more control of everything that they do, which is a little different, but I wish there was a little more freedom there for these guys to learn how to pitch as opposed to being told what to do all the time. But in the major leagues, you know, I like to communicate. I communicate a lot before the game. During the game, I do have input each inning. It can be quick. It can be a couple of words. It can be a sit down. It can be, you know, a talking about particular hitters. So, some pitchers like to talk and communicate a lot more. You got to kind of know your guy. Some guys like to tunnel vision and focus on what they're doing. And really it has to be something important when you do discuss something with them, because they don't want to get out of their train of thought. So every guy's different. You treat them a little bit differently, but I still think communication and positive words of encouragement. And then also really just reiterating the game plan. Hey, what we're going to do with this guy, you know, you got these three hitters coming up next inning. This is where you can attack him and just kind of keep them thinking that way.
Hey folks on Facebook, thanks for all your great comments. Love them. Do me a favor. If you got a question for Pete, type it in the comments section. Hey Pete, do you ever change, you know, what during the game, you know, a certain pitch, do you override any signs, you know, maybe you want a certain pitch thrown?
Yeah. We have some ways to get in touch with our catcher, Danny Jansen, Reese McGuire, Alejandro Kirk, you know, Caleb Joseph, guys we had this year. If they're ever stuck, and we do have signals, you know, from the bench in some way. I won't tell you how we do it.
No, but we won't tell you signals.
But we have ways that we can communicate if we really, really want a pitch in a certain situation. But our guys, again, We give them the freedom back there. We have a game plan. I don't want them, you know, being so caught up in having to do everything right that they can't function. It's hard to play a professional sport that way. There has to be freedom. You have to feel good about yourself. You got to have confidence in what you're doing. And I think that, you know, they do make some mistakes, and we talk about it in between innings, and then the next time we hope to rectify it. But I think it's you definitely have to give them the freedom. We do have catcher cards. We have plenty of information, you know, with these guys. So you just hate to overwhelm them too much. You do want them to feel like they're doing their own thing back there. We have a game plan. They're doing their own thing. If something really is important, the pitch that we want to make, sometimes we can get that to them for sure.
And tell me, just give me this a little bit. Tell me that there is some human element to the game still. I'm for statistics, but here's what I'm going to ask you, because you're seeing a big trend is obviously some pitchers, and obviously you can see the stats. They're batting 305 against that pitcher the third time around in the batting order.
I know.
So it makes sense. But what happens if you have a guy that's thrown really well? Does the manager have that discretion to keep him in there?
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, we went through this year, to be honest with you. We had a lot of short starts that were somewhat warranted. And then obviously because the pitchers weren't throwing that well at the time. But you know, I think, you know, it's always a manager's discretion and his decision. You know, and there is a lot of numbers thrown at us and in professional baseball, Major League Baseball. And you'd be a fool not to look at them for sure and utilize them. But I consider it all a tool. We get that information. We sift through it. We have the ability to do what we want to do. Our front office is fantastic from that aspect. We have tremendous people working in our analytics group. So it's eye-opening when you do get certain information. It's like, wow, mm-hmm. All right, geez, you know, we'll take a look at that.
Yeah.
You know, when a sinker's just not working. I mean, obviously you get feel and you know if someone's struggling on the mound, but maybe one particular pitch is getting hit a little bit harder than another pitch. And then maybe the next side session, you can work on it, or we move on from it and try to utilize the things that he's doing well. So we get great information. But when it comes to in-game decisions, I think every dugout in the big leagues, the manager does have the final say. It's just that the information is so pertinent, and sometimes it makes sense that it's easy to follow. I think it is, you know, everybody misses the days of nine innings and complete games and pitchers going deep. And I do too. I got to be honest with you. I do too. It was fun. You know, I think it was 15 or 16. I think we led the American League in quality starts, you know, so that means our starters were going six plus innings, giving up three runs or less. I think we had 106, you know, 110, something crazy. So, I mean, that was easy. Every day your relievers are ready. They're only getting, you know, 6 to 8 outs a night, you know, as opposed to half the game. So that sets up, obviously keeps everybody feeling good and healthy throughout the course of the season. So ultimately that's what you want. But in today's game, if you're struggling that third time through, you're probably coming out.
You know what? And I'm all for it. Don't get me wrong. I bring it up because I want our audience to understand it better. When I was at Mickey Owen Baseball School with young kids, we would always throw, you know, pitcher two innings, one inning, two, three innings. We'd mix it up because we didn't want everybody else to see that pitcher too long. So we get them. Hey, this is never going to happen. At least you could say this for sure. I'm going to have Denny McClain on the show next week. 1968. Perfect. 1968, 336 innings, 28 complete games.
That's awesome.
Yeah, we're never going to see that one, are we?
That sounds like Rick Langford, who used to be with us. He was with our organization for years, and he's a great friend. He had the same thing. You look up his numbers of consecutive starts, you know, complete games. I think it was like 28 or right around there in a row, you know, when he was at the Oakland A's. So it is a different world. Guys aren't expected, starting pitchers aren't expected to go that deep. But I think it's going to change a little bit next year. I think this year was an exception.
Yeah.
I know we've seen that trend happening. But I think when you get back to 162 games and you only got a 26-man roster, you got 7 or 8 relievers down there, the starting pitchers are going to have to go deeper. So, I mean, that's the way it is. So I think managers will be pushing those guys maybe through the third time through a little bit more next year.
Yeah, no, I agree. This year was a unique, and with the coronavirus, you know, the other thing, 60 games, guys were getting rushed to, you know, come back and start pitching. You couldn't throw those guys that long, that early. Here we have a question, but let me see. Bob Hirschfield asked the value, and we got about 10 more minutes, Pete, so you know, the value of a 1-1 pitch, he's asking.
Yeah. Yeah, obviously winning those counts, those leverage counts, you know, 1-1, 2-2. Like I said, getting ahead in the count's huge, but obviously if you can 1-1 go to 1-2, you're in the driver's seat. We know that. So that is a huge count and something we talk about. And it's frustrating when you're consistently 2-1. So I couldn't agree more. I think strike one's important, but I think when pitchers get to that 1-1 count, I'm curious what level he's at, if he coaches and what level it's at. But that swing count is the count for me. So again, I remember a while back, Casey Jansen was in our organization and we used to talk about that all the time, you know, the importance of that 1-1 count. So that's something we still express. And I think in that situation, you're going with your best pitch and you're throwing a strike. And cause you get the 1-2 foul ball, swing and miss, called strike. You really are. We know you're in the driver's seat. You got a real good opportunity to get that hitter out. So I think, you know, if you're talking to your young pitchers, you know, you express getting ahead in the count, of course, but 1-1 is a count to win. And I think if they had that in their head as a pitcher, that's going to make a difference through the course of the game, especially starting pitchers. I'm not saying it's important relievers too, but sure, sometimes the game's on the line with them. So they're going to be a little bit finer in those situations, but a starting pitcher should be winning the 1-1 count every time.
You know, prior our conversation we had right before this, I forgot to mention, you know, I listened to television today and one of the announcers said, well, the Dodgers just hope that, you know, Kershaw can go at least 4 or 5 innings. You know, that's the other thing. You never used to hear that. I mean, you know, a Hall of Famer, and you're saying that I hope he can go 4 innings. You know,
right.
It's a different game, as you mentioned. What about if I was to say what's unique, your best pitchers in the game, starting pitchers?
Yeah.
What they show you, do they show you that they have more than one pitch they can throw in behind in the count? Is that priority one?
I think so. I think you look at the best pitchers in the game. Obviously, they have power to their game, probably, when you think of the Gerrit Coles and the Verlanders. But they can also throw their breaking stuff anytime they want. And I think that's really critical. And the confidence to throw it anytime they want. They can locate their fastball. I think fastball command is still the most important thing. You can have good secondary stuff, but you need to command your fastball. I mean, I talk to Pat Henkin all the time. You know, he's with the Blue Jays, and he's fantastic with our young pitchers as well. But really, being able to command your there have been times, like, you know, you watch a bullpen with a young kid, and he's got great stuff, but he's just all over the place. Like, this kid's really – he's got to figure a way to throw strikes and get the ball where he wants to, or he's never going to advance. You can have the best stuff in the world, but if you can't command your fastball, you're in trouble. So that, to me, is still number one. But then, obviously, these elite starters can all throw their breaking stuff or their changeup or some kind of secondary pitch anytime. You know, and they can – so if they're behind 2-1, they still feel like they're in the driver's seat. They don't feel like they're, you know, their confidence isn't shaken, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So I do think secondary stuff anytime, fastball command – and then the last thing is still being able to pitch inside in today's game. I think it's a lost art. Guys that can do it effectively, you know, guys that have arm guards on and they're covered from head to toe with the shields and they're just so – they're not afraid. Hitters are just digging in, and that's where the game is a little bit different. But guys, pitchers still need to be able to locate their fastball in for a strike, in for a ball, and then in to move somebody. And I think that's a big part of the game that's lost. And I think, you know, you look at the way pitchers do pitch inside, it's not as effective as it used to be.
Interesting. And Bob Hirschfield, by the way, said on your response, that solid response. Thank you. A couple more things. You know, something you hear a lot is spin rate, whether it be on a curveball or fastball. And that's all great. I think it's great to measure all that stuff so it becomes better. But what are some methods? Are there some methods? I mean, you still got to be able to train to get better spin rate.
Yeah, no, I think there are some methods which increase it. I mean, we've seen that for grips, utilizing the seams better, you know, getting their mm-hmm. fingers in a better position. So those are the ways we do it. And sometimes we are able to increase some spin rates. But I think, you know, what we do well, and I'm sure other teams are out there, you know, that use different technology. We try to let the pitcher understand a little bit what's going on and how we're utilizing this technology. And then they can kind of see some results. But what we don't want is them to just fall in love with whatever it is. And just, that's all they think about, and get away from pitching. Cause you know, when you're in a key situation, nobody cares if you're, you know, at 2,400 or 2,200, for your spin rate, they could care less. It's about getting it out in that situation. So what you don't want is pitchers to rely on that kind of stuff. You want them to feel it, understand it, use it as a tool. But then when it's game time, it's go out and pitch. And that's something we express on a daily basis.
You know, something you're seeing also in Major League Baseball pitchers is, you know, the changeup used to be thrown, you know, with the circle change. And I know working with young kids, we always use three fingers because young kids don't have, you know, big enough fingers. But a lot of big league guys now are going to three-finger changeups.
Yeah, it's a comfortable grip. It keeps the rotation the way they want. It gets a little bit more vertical drop. You know, they find, so yeah, I mean, there's certainly still different ways to throw different pitches. And I think every guy, it depends on his arm action, his release. And then you work off his fastball, you know, cause you want to keep some, a similar rotation. But you do definitely want more vertical drop and maybe a little ball speed off of it as well. So there are different ways you can kill ball speed, you know, deeper grip, short, a little shorter stride, you know, taking a little bit off, you know, in that area. But, you know, for the most part, there are different ways to grip the ball for a changeup, for a breaking ball. And it's really just what's comfortable to that individual. And then you can use certain technology, Rapsodo and such, to kind of find a way to get the spin you're looking for and the actual release you're looking for.
Yeah, to measure to see if you're doing it right. You know, Ben, folks, you probably wonder, you know, your eyes don't pick up things like these high-speed cameras do. So obviously that helps. Yeah. Interesting to find out the three batter rule. How's it been? How do you like it? You think we ought to keep it?
I don't love it, to be honest with you. You know, it kept us from doing certain things in certain situations. Obviously, bringing guys in, it makes you think twice about bringing a guy in, and maybe in a situation you would have used a left hander or a right hander, you don't use them because they got to face three guys. I don't think it made a huge difference in the game. I don't think it really, you know, I don't know if it sped up the game or not by doing it. I think it hamstrung some managers into making certain moves in certain situations. I got to think most managers prefer not to have it and find other ways to speed up the game.
Yeah.
But, you know, we got used to it, and it was what it was. So I don't know if we'll keep it or not, but I don't know if it made a huge impact on the game. I would prefer to be able to, you know, not have it in place.
Yeah, and I agree with you. If you're going to do it for speeding up the game, don't change the strategy of the game to do that. Because that's what they did, where they changed the strategy. What's going to happen now, I got to believe as an outsider, what's going to happen is if this rule continues, now you guys are going to have to start changing either what pitchers you sign or how you develop them. Because you're going to need right-handers to throw to lefty and righties. You're going to need lefties to throw righties and lefties.
Correct. That's what happened this year. And that's how we looked at spring training going into the season. You know, the left-handers need to be able to get right-handers out. They need to have a decent changeup or a breaking ball that gets right-handers out. They have to have enough on their fastball to get right-handers out. So that's vice versa. Same with right-handers.
Yeah.
So you're going to take not necessarily a righty or lefty. You're going to take your best seven or eight relievers that can get both sides out. And and that's, you know, and it might push some lefties out, but it also might push some righties out, you know, that strictly just get right-handers out. So and you see those guys too, that are real dominant numbers against right-handers because they got a nasty slider or whatever, but they struggle against left-handers. So it puts both those guys in a tough position. That's why I'd prefer not to have it. But if they continue with it, you'll see that happen more and more.
Hey, what's been the consensus on runners on second base in the regular season? You know, on second base, extra innings.
Extra innings. Oh, I think guys loved it, to be honest with you. I don't mind it. We were in a lot of them, to be honest with you. I think we led all the baseball and extra inning games. So, really? So we were in the thick of it, and it seemed like every game was a tight game and we're concerned about extra innings. The one good thing about it is you don't burn your bullpen, which we would have this year in a big way. You just hate to lose that game. But it does, we learned a lot about strategy. You know, what we thought might happen didn't happen, and what we thought, you know, and vice versa, with guys bunting, not bunting, whether the visiting team, the home team. So I think we learned a lot about the strategy. So if they did keep it, I think we'd be in a good place. But I didn't mind it. And I think most of the coaches felt the same way. And I think the players didn't mind also. So I think that's a keeper.
All right, Pete, yeah, you've been great, man. The last one, and it's going to switch to your hitters a little bit. I'm just interested in when you talk about Guerrero, Biggio, Gurriel, Bichette, some of these young guys that have come up, you know, just doing really well. I'm just curious. We all know they got talent, obviously, hand-eye coordination, their athleticism and all that. What else makes them special that you've seen, why they've been so successful in a short period of time?
Well, obviously, they come from – their family tree is pretty good, so I think they grew up around the game. They know the game. They know what they can do. Every one of them is professional. They're great teammates. They pick each other up. They push each other. They control the strike zone. You know, I think of Bichette and Biggio. Gurriel's kind of the quiet one that comes along, and nobody talks about him much, but the kid's a hitter. He has great at-bats, and I think he's going to really have a huge year next year. But they just come to the yard to win, and they expect to win, and they're just not scared. They're fearless when they play. So I think, you know, I'm hoping they grow together, continue to grow together, and become such a strong nucleus for this organization moving forward. And I don't see why it wouldn't happen. Like I said, they're gamers, and they push each other, and I think they're all just tapping the surface right now as to what they can do.
Yeah, and you mentioned Gurriel. Man, the Cubans have made a major impact in Major League Baseball.
Oh, yeah.
Look at Arenzo Rhea with the Rays. I mean, unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah, he's been fun to watch. It's a great story watching this World Series play out and the performance that he's put on. And it should be an interesting World Series between those two teams. It's going to be a lot of fun.
And for your coaches out there, if you look at the Cuban hitters, you know, I've been lucky to be there 9 times, seen them a lot. You just noticed they're very quiet at home play. You know, it's just it's a little leg lift or it's a knee, you know, cock, and they work on their timing. They're just explosive. They're very good at what they do. Pete, this has been awesome, man. I know you got other things to do other than be on Baseball Outside the Box all day.
No, this is great. This has been a lot of fun. Anytime.
Hey, okay, finally. Mohegan Sun World Baseball Clinic. Give us the dates one more time. We'll put everything on the show notes, and we're going to be promoting it big time.
All right, you got January 11th and 12th, and then the 18th and 19th, which is a Monday and Tuesday. And it's baseballcoachesclinic.com, and it should be a great event. And really, really look forward to everybody being there and being a part of it and keeping this great event going.
All right, Pete. And thanks for having me, you know, being part of your convention. I'm looking forward to it. Thank you.
Yeah, I can't wait. Can't wait, Pete. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
All right. That's Pete Walker. I'm Pete Caliendo. Hey, listen, go to YouTube at Peter Caliendo. Subscribe and do us a favor. Just get the show out. Go, you know, all you got to do is share it if you can. Share it to all your coaches, players, and parents in the U.S. and around the world, all baseball levels, over 100 shows just on YouTube, and then go to Baseball Outside the Box. That's where the audio part is. Special thank you to our producer, Brian Kroc, Lineup Media Group. And of course, a special thank you to all our guests and everybody in the U.S. and around the world who joined the show. Really appreciate it. We've got some loyal listeners with over 100 countries listening. Really appreciate it. Everybody stay safe. God bless y'all. Hopefully you'll be back in the field soon and watch the World Series starts today. Bye-bye, everybody.
This has been Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Listen online at baseballoutsidethebox.com and subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and all major podcast outlets. Join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Get all of our podcasts now at lineupmedia.fm.